This is Advent, a time of expectancy, a time for patient waiting. We wait for the birth of Jesus, and we wait for the war in the Gulf. Despite the good news that direct talks between Washington and Baghdad will begin within the next 2 weeks, the countdown to war has begun. With the UN resolution on the use of force now on the books, and Saddam Hussein more defiant, only a miracle, it seems, can avert that war. To make his intention to use force believable, President Bush has ordered more than 400,000 troops to Saudi Arabia and to the surrounding waters. As leaves are canceled and enlistments extended, the nation is on a war footing for the first time since the massive intervention in Vietnam. Both the President and the Joint Chiefs of Staff hope that threatening war, followed by face-to-face talks, will avoid war. But the massive troop deployments and the escalating rhetoric are creating their own momentum. The arguments for getting it over with before the holy month of Ramadan in the Islamic world, before the morale of the troops in the desert sinks further, or before the April heat sets in, or before Saddam completes the crude atomic weapon the United States says he's building, are becoming more and more insistent and more shrill. War is the great tempter of nations. And first Saddam, and now the President of the United States, have fallen victim. Throw yourself off the parapet, the tempter challenged Jesus, and the angels will be your parachute. Do something foolish and count on your God to save you. When that didn't work, the tempter promises the world. All these I will give you if you will only fall down and do me homage, he says to Jesus after he has taken him to the mountaintop and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in their glory. War, the tempter of nations, says, I will make you secure in your riches. I will provide gainful employment, and I will provide excitement and purpose for your life. My bombs, my missiles, my bullets will bring justice to the world, a new world order. My tanks and planes offer you your only chance to escape death. My supply of weapons is as inexhaustible as the supply of enemies, and I will not leave you without enemies and just causes. I will give you the satisfaction of grinding your enemies into the dust. I will prove that you are right, because those who oppose you are dead or humbled. I will hand you the pen with which to write the winner's history, the only history that counts, and I will make the world your footstool. You don't have to pay homage to me. You can curse me and say you hate me. I know I have a bad name. Honest people like Teddy Roosevelt, who said he loved war, are out of fashion these days. All you have to do is this. Have the old men send the young men to die. Have the rich send the poor. Have the whites send the blacks. Tell them nothing or tell them lies. Harden your heart, stiffen your will, stand firm in your pride. I release you from the rules of civilization. I call on you to burn, to gas, eviscerate men, women, and babies, and I make it easy to do this, because you can do it by the thousands from far off, from up in the sky or from behind the missile. It's a lot easier than doing it one by one and face to face. If you threaten to kill, you probably won't have to. And if you have to, remember, you're killing for peace. And then the biggest lie of all, you don't have any alternative. George Bush is too political a creature not to appreciate the serious risk that his presidency could crash in flames once the body bags come back from the Middle East. Neither the new Arab allies of the United States, the reluctant Soviet partner, nor the old European allies are enthusiastic about fighting Saddam. Democratic leaders like Senators Sam Nunn and Daniel P. Moynihan have been openly critical of Bush's handling of his Gulf strategy, and if history is any guide, the criticism will escalate as the casualties mount and the American people begin voicing the frustration they always feel when wars last too long. All the more reason, then, perhaps, to get it over with before the 1992 campaign begins in earnest. The top generals at the Pentagon may be grateful to Saddam for providing a dramatic illustration of the new post-Cold War threats and terrors, just as talk of peace dividends, lean forces, and slashed military budgets was reverberating in the halls of Congress. But like most generals most of the time, they do not feel ready for war. If the slashing press accounts of stalled tanks, malfunctioning helicopters, and logistical and morale problems facing untested troops in a brutal environment are even partially true, the overwhelming American force in the desert, even when it is reinforced, is unlikely to shoot its way to a quick and costless victory. But the Washington generals are themselves trapped in the desert. How can you ask for nearly $300 billion a year, every year, year after year, and not be ready to take on this evil and dangerous force, who the president has declared threatens the world's oil reserves, the peace of the Middle East, and the New World Order? As risky as war may be for Mr. Bush, it may well appear politically easier to send the troops to the Gulf and commit them to battle than to bring them home without achieving the high purposes for which they were sent. The president has steadily escalated the rhetorical commitment. He has said that Saddam is worse than Hitler, and that he's hell-bent to add nuclear weapons to his arsenal of biological and chemical warheads. The message is clear. Negotiation is impossible, and war soon is preferable to war later. The Iraqi leader has shown no sign of withdrawing from Kuwait. Instead, he has more than matched the U.S. reinforcements by shoring up his own forces. The president is spending his principal energy building an international coalition to use force. But the force that will do the fighting and dying will be 80% American. There is little to suggest that the policy of righteous indignation, saber-rattling, blockade, and the threat of war to come will work. Even in the unlikely event that Saddam withdraws at the last moment, the United States will not, cannot, simply pack up and come home. A new security arrangement for the region would have to be negotiated with Saddam still in power. Once he is out of Kuwait, the decapitating strike at his government, the preferred negotiating tactic of the former chief of staff of the Air Force, would have no world support. Why would an ego-bruised and vengeful Saddam, sitting on the Kuwaiti border with his forces intact, be an easier or more trustworthy negotiating partner than he is today? One could have more confidence in the president's strategy if the road to war he has already traveled were not littered with miscalculations and mixed signals on both sides. On July 24, 1990, a week before the invasion of Kuwait, Margaret Tutwiler, the State Department spokesperson, declared that the U.S. had no commitment to come to the defense of Kuwait, contradicting directly the Secretary of Defense statement earlier that day. She added, however, that the U.S., quote, remains strongly committed to supporting the individual and collective self-defense of our friends. The next day, United States Ambassador April Glaspie told Saddam, I have direct instructions from the President to seek better relations with Iraq. We have no opinion on the Arab-Arab conflicts, like your border disagreement with Kuwait. For his part, Saddam Hussein falsely assured King Fahd of Saudi Arabia that he would not invade Kuwait, and his spokesman falsely promised to withdraw. Those who sent the mixed signals that got us into this crisis seem very unlikely to be able to signal their way out. War is therefore likely for three reasons. First, unlike the cynical adventures in Grenada and Panama, genuine, emotionally charged principles are indeed at stake in this crisis. Second, no alternative to war has yet been placed on the political agenda by any credible political figure or movement. The talks that the president initiated in his press conference 2 days ago have so far been explained by the highest administration official to speak on the subject, the vice president, as a an oral communication of the existing positions of the United States, and under no circumstances would other issues relating to the Middle East be up for negotiation. Whether that is true or not, we will see. But that is the position of the vice president. Third reason why war is likely is that the protagonists are not wholly in control of the events. A provocation that could instantly ignite the war could come from a number of directions. We have arrived at a moment in world history when, for the first time in 150 years, the great powers recognize the futility of war against one another, and the chance for a genuine collective security system is greater than it has ever been. Two former chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have publicly opposed the rush to war because they understand the catastrophic consequence for the people of the United States and for the people in the region. Consider this best-case scenario offered by a retired senior, retired U.S. general in my presence. The war would begin with massive bombardment of Iraqi defensive positions, decapitating strikes on command and control centers, as well as nuclear and poison gas installations. This would be followed by an unavoidable ground war, which would take about 3 weeks. The price of victory would be at least 40,000 casualties, including 10,000 deaths, and 90% of the casualties, he estimated, would be American. The U.S. troops slogged their way to Baghdad. What then? The country is a ruin. There are hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths and casualties, wounded and dead, and refugees. Only the professional hawks of the op-ed pages talk about surgical strikes. As scenes of the U.S.-directed carnage dominate the nightly news, the entire region seethes with hatred of the imperialist butchers, the infidels, the baby killers of Baghdad. The Allies run for cover. Like some of the unhappy troops in the desert who joined the army to learn computers or auto repair, Germany, Japan, and other funders and token participants in Operation Desert Shield will protest that they hadn't really bargained for a shooting war. Okay to scare them, but war is another matter. That's the best case. Add flaming oil fields, Israeli involvement, $75 a barrel oil, global economic shock, ugly recriminations among the victorious brothers in arms, and a politically divided, economically paralyzed United States. Unless, as sometimes I think George Bush must believe, God is a Republican, something less pleasant than the best case is in store for the American people and for the world once the dogs of war are loosed. It is not that the president is unaware of these possibilities, although he has scrupulously avoided consulting experts on the Middle East who could tell him that the anger in the street against the United States has already reached the boiling point in much of the Arab world. He feels trapped by what he has said and what he has done, and that's the way most wars start. No, it isn't working out as it hoped. The sanctions are causing hardship and deterioration in Saddam's military forces, but according to U.S. intelligence reports that have been leaked to the press, the impact is less than predicted. The Iraqis have had a good harvest this year. Saddam has eliminated his political enemies, and his country is so honeycombed with informers that a plot to overthrow him seems unlikely. Like it or not, he is a popular figure, a symbol of Arab nationalism and Islam in his own country and in the region. As the Vietnam experience suggests, poor dictatorships can play the waiting game better than rich democracies. The war preparations cost the United States now about $1 billion a month. The morale of the troops under the boiling sun and the impatience of the American people with the crisis in the Gulf set limits to the wait and hope strategy. But even the senators who are cautious about going to war appear to share the consensus that negotiation with the beast of Baghdad is impossible. Until the last few days, congressional concern has focused more on the president's neglect of the lawmakers' constitutional prerogatives, which they have given away over the years, than on the wisdom of his policy. But it seems now that the choices are very clear, although what lies at the end of each road is not clear. And the choices are wait and hope, war, and negotiations now. The first two make no sense except as strategies to accomplish the third. That is a negotiated settlement. The sanctions alone cannot restore peace or order to the region. Iraq, intact or destroyed, with Saddam or without, will at some point have to participate in the negotiating process. For all of the hype emanating from the White House, Saddam is indeed a very menacing figure. He has made threats to use weapons of mass destruction, and the fact that he gassed thousands of Iranians and Kurds means that the threat has to be taken seriously. But he is no Hitler. He controls an impoverished, underdeveloped country, which is dependent on foreign technology, not the industrial powerhouse that Hitler had created by 1938. He faces an overwhelming force that has already been committed against him, not the weak and divided democracies that try to avoid war through appeasement. Nor is he a unique figure. One reason why the alliance against him is so shaky is that he cannot be destroyed without at the same time making Iran the dominant power in the region. Our new ally, Hafez Assad of Syria, now an honorary former terrorist, is as vicious as Saddam and smarter. Important principles have been invoked in the defense of U.S. policy in the Gulf crisis, but defense of democracy is not one of them. Yet the threat of nuclear proliferation and aggression against small states are issues which must be addressed. To be sure, Kuwait is an artificial state created by colonial officials, and it was run by the Sabahs as a family corporation. Nevertheless, it's as legitimate as many other members of the United Nations, and if you use that criteria, you could look the other way and see a lot of states disappear. If small states are allowed to disappear at the hands of covetous neighbors, the world is in for an endless cycle of arms races and preemptive wars. The United States, France, the Soviet Union, and other nations, as everyone now knows, helped to make Saddam the number one military power in the region. It was an incredibly foolish policy, driven by the trade deficit and crackpot realpolitik. You can almost hear President Reagan's voice as he signs the fateful document calling for the tilt to Iraq. But President Bush's alarm about saying that he's just not going to let Khomeini push the United States around, just as today we aren't going to let Saddam, so we talk now about dealing with Assad of Syria. Negotiation is the rational road out of the crisis, the morally defensible road, and the only one likely to work. That is, the only one that could produce the desired outcome without absolutely unacceptable consequences. It said, how can you negotiate with an undefeated enemy? Well, that is, of course, the only kind of adversary you do negotiate with. Once he is defeated, the negotiation becomes a surrender ceremony. The American tradition is unconditional surrender, from the Civil War to World War II. And the end of the Cold War, with the collapse of communism and the embrace of capitalist values in the Soviet Union, is another apparent vindication of the unconditional surrender policy. However, the problem with settling complex political, economic, and cultural disputes by force, overwhelming force, quite apart from the mass murder and property destruction it requires, is that the victor is still stuck with the problem. He can either walk away from the carnage he has caused, occupy the defeated country, or pay for its reconstruction. All three involve enormous costs. A negotiated settlement that had a chance to avoid future war and to bring stability in the region would need the following elements, it seems to me. And I put this forward for your consideration. One, a timetable for the complete withdrawal of Iraqi troops from Kuwait. The withdrawal would be in tandem with a staged withdrawal of U.S. and other U.N. forces from the region. something that is certainly in our interest in any event. I'm talking about the U.S. forces. To provide a face-saving context for Saddam to extricate himself and us is hardly reward for aggression. It is the result that counts. Humiliating Saddam is neither a necessary, worthy, nor particularly prudent objective. But the package must include provisions that set limits to Iraq's ambition and military power. A structure for the settlement of the border dispute between Iraq and Kuwait. The dispute over the islands, access to the sea, and exploitation of the oil fields on the border could be submitted to the World Court or to a special commission set up by the Arab League under the auspices of the United Nations. 3, a regional security conference under the auspices of the Security Council of the United Nations. Its mission would be the elimination of weapons of mass destruction in the region, reduction of arms levels, the control of arms exports to the region, and the establishment of an inspection system along the lines of the ones developed for Europe. The arms-producing countries would declare a moratorium on all arms sales to the region while the conference is negotiating this security arrangement. Israel, Egypt, and Iraq have all proposed the creation, at one time or another, of a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. The survival of Israel ultimately depends upon it. 4, a regional peace conference should meet simultaneously to work out a treaty to end the 45-year war in the Middle East. The security of Israel's 1967 borders should be underwritten by the Security Council and all regional powers. The West Bank and Gaza should be returned to a newly created state, Palestinian state, that unequivocally recognizes the 1967 borders, renounces all attempts to change the status quo by force, and accepts low level of armaments and international inspection, and perhaps some kind of UN force to guarantee it. Other military occupations, including Syria's occupation of portions of Lebanon, should be ended. 5, the causes of instability in the region must be urgently addressed. 17 out of 20 Arab states show a declining gross national product. 60% of their populations are under 20. No wonder that Arab masses without a future embrace fanatical fundamentalism and Arab nationalism, following brutal, despotic leaders who at least offer them pride. Investment funds from the industrial world are needed to deal with water and other environmental problems of concern to the whole world. But the major funding should come from the thinly populated oil-producing countries that have most of the money in the region. The political evolution of the region towards greater justice and equality for the people of the Arab world is essential for stability and peace. And make no mistake, the status quo before August 2nd cannot return. That is the one thing we can be sure of. A United Nations effort can provide a framework by supporting forces for democratic and progressive change in the region. But once border questions are settled, the establishment of a stable order depends critically upon the Arab nations themselves. This crisis has created what is perhaps the last chance to deal with questions that should have been dealt with a long, long time ago. If it is allowed to pass and positions harden further, the Arab-Israeli confrontation, in my view, will almost certainly lead someday to nuclear war. This is the season of waiting for miracles. It's just possible that we may be witnessing one. It is unprecedented for a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to criticize presidential war policy on the eve of war. And two have done this. Public opposition to the human sacrifice in the desert is rising all over this country. The last 18 months have been a time of democratic miracles. People rising up in Czechoslovakia and all through Eastern Europe, throwing off the yoke of oppression and fear. But we who already have the gift of free expression, the right to assemble in the streets and protest, the right to instruct our representatives about our deepest convictions, must exercise that right now. We need to send a signal that we do not believe the tempter's lie. War and appeasement are not the only alternatives. Let us pray for the strength to be part of the miracle, and if it be God's will, to make it happen. Amen.